Lucis Trust, a non-profit, non-political, and non-sectarian organization on the roster of the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations, and concerned with the establishment of world cooperation and goodwill, presents Inner Sight with your host, Robert Anderson. He, with Sarah and Dale McKechnie, President and Vice President of Lucis Trust, will discuss philosophical and spiritual topics essential to everyday life. Now here's your host, Robert Anderson.
Welcome. Inner sight is simply seeing that which is always present, but not yet fully recognized. You have, within you, the ability to see yourself and the world around you in a new way, with new eyes. So, stay with us, and together, we'll look at the world and ourselves with inner sight. Our topic for today, the psychology of God. Subtitle is The Factor of Analysis, Part 5. Before we explore this topic, I'd like to say a few words about Alice Bailey, founder of the Lucis Trust. Alice Bailey wrote 24 books of esoteric philosophy, and those 24 books are the main inspiration for the dialogue that you hear on this show. The following thought is also from the works of Alice Bailey. The fifth conditioning quality of the soul is the factor of analysis. It's a law that governs humanity. Analysis and the power to discriminate are divine attributes. This sounds as if analysis is an aspect of the consciousness of God. So how come we tend to think of analysis as focusing on the smallest detail and overlooking the real significance? Analysis doesn't seem very spiritual to me.
I can understand that. I suppose we all get a mental image of a scientist in a lab coat holding up a test tube to the light and studying its infinite tiny details. That's one type of analysis, and it's good. Scientists and others, bookkeepers and accountants who work on the level of the fine detail, keep the wheels of life humming, and they expand our understanding, particularly in science, of the minutest aspect of our planetary life. In fact, I think the scientific understanding of life on the cellular level and the atomic level is deepening at an incredible rate, at the same time that we are expanding our understanding of the vastness of space. Both are needed, and both, I think, are expressions of analysis, but I think we're also aware as human beings that the tendency to analyze can lead to nitpicking and a critical, unsatisfied, judgmental tendency of the personality. That's because we aren't approaching this law, which it is. The factor of analysis is a law, a spiritual law. We're not approaching it as it exists in the mind of God. And these programs are an attempt to express or understand a small portion of the psychology of God. These seven attributes are given in the books of Alice Bailey as ways that we human beings can understand the divine psyche. These are, after all, called the psychology of God. And because we are made by God, these attributes also exist in human beings. So the tendency or the capacity to analyze is a necessary component of the human mind.
Yes, it's another way of saying we are made in the image of God, and this is part of that image. Our image is not just this physical image, because we have this same psychology, the same attributes that are passed on from God, and these constitute part of that divine image, in a sense. And this factor of analysis, which we're talking about today, is what is most prominent in human thinking now. It's the way we think in the concrete level, and that's what the concrete mind is supposed to do. It's supposed to analyze and to take things apart and see the differences in everything, and this is just what the human mind is doing now to a very great extent.
I suppose fashion designers do that when they take apart a dress and figure out how it was made, and they reassemble the creation themselves. People who work in restaurants deconstruct a dish and learn how to recreate it. Those are types of analysis, but we're talking about something on a much higher level today. It reminds me of a capacity that the great musician and composer Leonard Bernstein apparently had. I remember reading when he died that his obituary mentioned that as a musician, he would take a score, sit down with it, and examine it down to the very last note and detail until he was finally satisfied that he knew that score inside out. Then he was ready to perform it. And I thought that was so interesting, that that expansive, jovial personality had at the same time this infinite precision as a musician to examine a score from the inside out until he knew its every detail. Then he could perform it as a whole piece, in its entirety, as a beautiful composition, but he had to have that foundation of an understanding of all the component parts. That is a little bit of an approximation, I think, of what we're talking about on a spiritual level, where analysis comes in. And as I understand it, our role, humanity, is to use our mind, because, as we know, man is from the Sanskrit manas, meaning one who thinks. We are supposed to use our mind to understand the world, the planet, and all that lives upon it, and to be able to recognize the touch of divinity within every fragment of our planetary life.
Yes, the focus should be at that level. And too often, though, we find today this tendency to discriminate, this ability, it's a capacity that we have, and it's good, this ability to discriminate and to distinguish one from the other, but it sometimes, too often, it tends to degenerate into a criticism. Rather than a critique of something, it develops into a criticism, and then that becomes a negative thing. And that's a misuse of this divine quality of analysis that we have.
I suppose what happens is that that capacity to analyze, to perceive and note, becomes a way of finding fault, because it strengthens a separatism in the personality that's looking on and that judges and finds the other person being observed as a lesser being and oneself as a greater being. This is a misuse of the factor of analysis, which Alice Bailey says must be applied within the field of synthesis. When I first read that, and probably the second and fifth and tenth times I read that, I thought to myself, what does she mean? The factor of analysis must be applied within the field of synthesis. But I think what she's saying is we can only understand or use the mind to note the fragments, the component parts, if at the same time, or ultimately, we see the wholeness of which they are tiny parts. And it's the same with looking at another human being. If we're going to note their characteristics, we have to never lose sight of their soul, their relationship, and their ability to express a fragment of divinity. Then we see them in the proper proportion. I mean, after all, Alice Bailey said, harmlessness is the completed point of view. Harmlessness is the completed point of view.
That's interesting.
Isn't it? Yeah. At first, again, you say, what? What does that mean?
Yeah, you got me thinking about that.
Harmlessness is the completed point of view. It means you see the whole person, not just that which strikes your attention, because quite often what strikes your attention is something that you are busily denying in yourself.
So perhaps the whole view might be to look for the divinity within all people, regardless of whatever stage they're at right now.
Always. That's a good position to start from. Then you have the ability to see the less than perfected areas within them without becoming judgmental or discouraged or critical, because you see them in their, well, as my friend's mother said, in their immaculate concept, their ultimate perfection. I love that phrase.
Yes, and that trying to see from that angle is a good exercise in trying to see from the angle of the soul, because the soul sees the whole, and it knows the whole plan and what the plan is working out. And so it doesn't judge. It just conveys that pure love of the love of God into its creation. And so that's why we have to try to think in those terms and think as the soul in the world and not as this self-centered, very personal personality.
One of our problems, I suppose, as human beings is that we are working with a brain and through a brain. And it's the brain, as I understand it, that is governed by the senses of time and space. Time being the sense that things are broken up into fragments, one preceding the other, and so on and so forth. Rather than seeing the wholeness all at once, the eternal presence, we see life in terms of past, present, and future. And that means that we don't really see the synthesis, the field of synthesis in which we should be analyzing. Alice Bailey said that the masters, the spiritual hierarchy, use analysis in terms of the law of cycles. They understand that there's an ebb and flow to life, that there is a light and a dark, and that there is a in-breathing and out-breathing. And with that acute sense of timing, they know how to apply energy, how to apply stimulation, or as she says, emphasis. I suppose anybody who raises a child or anybody who works, say, in a legislature of any sort knows that the factor of timing is terribly important. There's a time and a place for everything. Mm-hmm. And if you're not working in that right timing, even the best idea isn't going to materialize.
Yes, and that's being able to see what is working out behind all of these little bits and parts and pieces. And in terms of legislation, I suppose it's being able to see how this is, when is the best time to bring a piece of legislation forward so that it has the most beneficial effect.
And that's a use of discrimination in its proper sense, being able to judge the timing, to be able to know when the proper cycle has arrived. It implies great wisdom and also an ability to see things as they are, which is analysis.
For those people who just tuned in, you're listening to Inner Sight, our topic for today, The Psychology of God. The subtitle is The Factor of Analysis, Part 5. We have a special offer from the Lucis Trust. We've offered it before. Many of you have taken advantage of it and have enjoyed it. It's a paper on the psychology of God, which is today's topic. And it'll afford you the opportunity to look at this topic in greater depth. Now, it's totally for free. There is no cost whatsoever, not even a shipping charge. So if you'd like to have this paper, please give us a call at 1-866-695-8247. That's 1-866-695-8247. Now, The Psychology of God, it's a paper that's been taken from Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2, by Alice Bailey. So it'll probably stimulate your interest to buy the entire book. And by the way, we're not like a lot of companies. If you request this paper and enjoy reading it, you're not going to get a phone call whereby we ask you what you thought and whether or not you're going to buy the larger book. It's totally yours, free, no strings attached. So that's a question that people always seem to want to know. But give us a call then. The easy way to remember the phone number is 1-866-NY-LUSIS. Think of 1-866-NEW-YORK-LUSIS. LUSIS is L-U-C-I-S. Now, by the way, donations to LUSIS Trust are tax-deductible and can be sent to LUSIS Trust, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. We appreciate your donations, large and small. They're an expression to us of your support. We thoroughly appreciate them because those donations, and well, that's what keeps us on the air and enables us to continue doing these radio shows for you. So thanks again for what you've contributed in the past, and please continue to do so. We'd certainly like to continue doing these shows. So once again, donations can be sent to LUSIS Trust, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. And by the way, all of our Inner Sight programs can be heard on our website at www.lucistrust.org. On the homepage, you'll find a link to today's program, which will be available for hearing in a day or two. Last week's program is already available, and many of our past programs can also be heard. Once again, it's www.lucistrust.org. The theme of each week's program is posted in advance on our website, so you can see in advance what next Sunday's program will be. I was thinking the discipline of math, but in particular geometry. I remember I didn't start doing well in geometry in high school until it occurred to me that geometry is teaching me how to think. There are several items that you are given. And from the givens, you are supposed to come to a conclusion and form a solution to the problem. Would that be an example of analysis, or?
Yes, I think so. You can't come to the solution until you've noted all the various givens. If you jump over some of those, you come up with the wrong answer in math. Math is very exacting, and it's wonderful training for the mind because there's no cutting corners, as far as I know. This is hilarious, me speaking about mathematics with any sense of proficiency at all, but I appreciate it.
I think I'm in sync with you on that because it wasn't until I learned this humanitarian value of teaching the thought process in a better way that I finally said, hey, this is for me.
I don't know. There are so many ways in which we trip ourselves up. I've been reading a book that's helping me to understand this factor of analysis. Alan Watts, the once upon a time Anglican priest turned Buddhist, wrote a book called The Book on the Taboo of Knowing Who You Are. And he talks in this book about the problem we have in the way we use our minds that deconstructs or compartmentalizes everything we see in the world without seeing the whole picture. And he gives this wonderful analogy of somebody looking through a picket fence as a cat walks by. So you're looking through the picket fence through this narrow opening, and a cat comes by. First you see the head, then you see the furry torso, and then you see the tail. Okay, then the cat turns around and comes back, and again you see the head followed by the furry torso followed by the tail. And then he does another U-turn and again walks by you, head, torso, tail, so that you think that the head always precedes the tail. And he says that with this view of the world, you miss the fact that every cat is a headed tail cat, a complete creature, and not one whose head always precedes the tail. You fail to see the wholeness of the creature by looking through the slatted picket fence, and that's how we look at much of the world. Again, I think part of the problem is the brain with its tendency to break things down by time and space. But we need to learn to see the wholeness of life, and it's not easy. He says, can we imagine one lonely body, the only ball in the universe, in the midst of empty space? No, because there would be no energy, no motion to it. We see things in relation to others. We understand ourselves in relation to others. But at the same time, if we use that discrimination to separate ourselves apart from others, we're failing to see the one humanity.
And that's the real task, is to see the relationship, because behind the plan, and the plan calls for building relationships on the pathway, on the return path back to God. In other words, you can't walk on this return path without building relationships, because that is the fundamental way of bringing all these parts and pieces together into seeing the whole. And so it's the ability of the mind to distinguish between parts, between forms, is the beginning stage of a much higher kind of discrimination, to distinguish differences in consciousness. And as we move up the scale of consciousness, it becomes ever finer and finer distinctions that have to be analyzed and decided upon and recognized. And those build the relationship, but in the realm of consciousness.
Another problem that we create for ourselves in building that consciousness is that we don't properly appreciate the pairs of opposites. And all the great spiritual teachings say this. The Buddha taught the noble middle way, which runs between the pairs of opposites. It's very difficult to understand why we shouldn't cleave to one or the other, the one we favor over the one we dislike. And yet, as Alan Watts and all great spiritual teachers affirm, it's only in their coupling, in their completeness, that the pairs of opposites express unity. Both are needed. Alan Watts said that we miss the fact that poles or aspects are really expressing the same thing, but from two opposite polarities of the spectrum. But at the same time, we have no word, no vocabulary for that thing which the pairs of opposites express. The best we can call it is existence or being or God or the great ocean of being or the ultimate ground. We don't have the vocabulary for that wholeness, that field of synthesis.
I think that finding that pairs of opposites, and it comes out as the third way sometimes. Mm-hmm. We've seen this in certain political discussions of finding a third way of between two opposing political points of view or two ethnic points of view that people are so dogmatic about holding on to. But it's finding that middle ground that is really the way out. Because as long as you hold to the extremes, you're never going to get ahead. You're just going to stay at the extreme levels. And it's finding that middle path, which is the pathway of the Buddha, the path of compassion of the Buddha. And he had that complete point of view of compassion that could see the whole from the end as well as the part. And that's why he was advocated that finding that middle path.
I think all of our suffering as human beings is that we get stuck on one side, one aspect of the pairs of opposites, and don't reconcile with the other, don't incorporate it. The ultimate pairs of opposites that hang us up are life and death. We favor life and dislike death and fear it and put it off as long as we can. We don't see that life and death are part of a wholeness. They're that law of cycles that I was talking about earlier. We need both. We need life. We need death, followed by more life. It's all a cycle, all a flow. The great teachings affirm this, but our whole Western orientation is to staving off death for as long as possible, because we believe that life is only lived here on the material plane. And again, the factor of analysis has hypnotized us into believing all the fragments of the tangible world are real and everything else is not.
Yes, our study is too much oriented on the brain itself and the brain cells and the minute particles in the brain and the minute sections of the brain. And we're not able to see that this brain is perhaps just an organ and that there is something actually bigger and more lifelike that is working through it, more of a realm of consciousness.
One might ask then, how come we're afflicted with a brain and have to use it here on Earth? I can only think that it's part of the intention of deity to know itself on the lowest level of our planetary life, and to recognize its oneness with itself on the highest plane of life. The Ageless Wisdom says there are seven planes of existence, and with each of those seven planes is further differentiated into seven subplanes. All of them are expressive divinity, but we have to become awake and aware of that. And that's our role as human beings. Because we have a mind, we are supposed to be able to perceive deity, divinity, in the tiniest and most material fragment.
Right, and it's the capacity of the brain to see and to analyze the material world, but it has to realize that it's only one-seventh or one part of this great, these seven stages that you mentioned, and that there are like six other stages of consciousness that lie beyond the brain's, brain itself, but actually work through the brain in order to make contact with the physical world.
Well summed up.
Well, you know, you were also saying that that life and death are part of the same concept. Now, if that's so, then should people be afraid of death?
Not at all. They should be ready for the next stage, whatever it is.
Please take advantage of the special offer from the Lucis Trust, and that's the paper entitled The Psychology of God. It's totally for free, no strings attached. It's taken from Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2, by Alice Bailey. So give us a call and request the paper. We'll be happy to send it out to you, once again, free of charge. The title of it, once again, The Psychology of God. Give us a call at 1-866-695-8247. That's 1-866-695-8247. The easy way to remember it is 1-866-NY-LUCIS. Think of 1-866-NY-LUCIS. You've been listening to Inner Sight. Now we would like to close with a world prayer called The Great Invocation. It's a call for light and love and goodwill to flow into the world and into our hearts. Let's listen for a moment to these powerful words.
From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into human minds. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into human hearts. May the coming one return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide all little human wills, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the human race, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth.